is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. If you're looking for political talk, try somewhere else. Hot Talk, another channel. But if you're looking for stories, that's what we do here on Our American Stories. And recently, our field correspondent, Alex Cortez, brought us a very strange report about a very strange law in the state of Wisconsin. And we like to report on what's going on in the states. You won't hear a lot of D.C. and New York and L.A. talk here, and that there's a reason for that. And by the way, those cities are filled with people who are from everywhere else, too. So it was about time we started talking about what's going on in the large swath of this country called flyover country. Well, it was so strange we felt compelled to do a second installment, and here's Alex.
Last week, we heard about some strange news reports like this one.
Curiosity leads to large crowds in Mobile's Crichton community. Many of you bringing binoculars, camcorders, even camera phones to take pictures.
To me, it looked like a leprechaun to me. I got to look up in a tree. Who else in the leprechaun say yeah?
Yeah! Eyewitnesses say the leprechaun only comes out at night. If you shine a light in its direction, it suddenly disappears.
And then the strangest one of them all.
Low prices are part of the Meijer business model, but are they too low? The company says it's never encountered this type of situation in any other state where it operates.
Low prices that are too low? Our brains and our wallets were so unsettled that we had to find out what on earth was going on here and whether we were still even on the planet Earth. And so we asked an expert, the president of a think tank called the McIver Institute. And more importantly, Brett Healy is a Wisconsin resident and expert shopper.
Wisconsin's minimum markup law is a relic from the distant past. It was originally passed back in 1939, and essentially the law makes it illegal for retailers and wholesalers to sell merchandise at a discount.
But it's not just Meijer and their customers who were affected. Today, we hear about Walmart.
We did an analysis of Walmart flyers from Milwaukee, Chicago, and Minneapolis during the back-to-school days when so many retailers are offering low prices in an attempt to convince you to come to their store to buy your back-to-school supplies. And what we found was that the minimum markup law in Wisconsin is having a real impact on Wisconsinites, and it's a costly one. Elmer Glue Sticks in Chicago went for 50 cents a pop during the back-to-school sales. In Milwaukee, because of the minimum markup law, that same glue stick had to be sold for $1.25. So that's a 150% increase thanks to the minimum markup law. We saw the same sort of prices for other items like markers and notebooks. In each of these situations, you're seeing a 50 to 70% markup on the cost of back-to-school supplies.
Back to school, to prove to Dad that I'm not a fool. I got my lunch packed up, my boots tied tight. I hope I don't get in a fight.
He was pretty somber there, but Adam Sandler got really riled up when we told him about his prescription drugs.
Walmart has a very popular generic prescription drug program where they sell for $4, 350 different drugs. In Wisconsin, however, they're not able to sell all of those drugs at that $4 price.
All right!
Because of the minimum markup law, a certain number of the drugs here in Wisconsin are required to be sold at $8.
Once again, things that could have been brought to my attention yesterday!
Which is a 100% increase over what people in other states are getting their drugs for.
You blew it!
In this area alone, Wisconsinites are being charged up to $35 million more a year for prescription drugs.
Will you give me a break one time?
This isn't some esoteric debate in ivory towers. This is a public policy issue that has an impact on real Wisconsinites, and it's costing them big money out of their checkbooks.
Oh, you're sick! You're sick! Why would you do that?
Adam Sandler, he speaks and he screams.
Do you understand me?
On behalf of the rest of us, Walmart is now closing 4 locations in the state of Wisconsin. The state's minimum markup law may have had something to do with it. To what degree, we'll never know. And yet those most affected by the law might not even be the big retailers like Walmart or Meijer, or even Wisconsin consumers. It might be the very small businesses who claim they need the law to protect their higher profit margins.
With the advance of the internet and people becoming more and more comfortable purchasing their products through the internet, people are going to turn to the internet more and more to get the lowest prices.
In the age of the internet, fewer folks will go to these mom-and-pop shops with prices that they know are higher.
And we won't because of the minimum markup law.
Families like Brett's know that they can often get better prices for the very same goods online.
My family is a perfect example of that. My wife loves Walmart.com. We get a box every two or three days at the house through the mail from Walmart.com of the everyday household products that we use, the best price possible.
The mom-and-pop shops, the Meijers, the Walmarts, all should be given a chance to compete freely, to fight to be the best they can be in the marketplace. And as consumers, for us to spend our own money freely.
If more Wisconsinites knew about the minimum markup law and knew that there was bureaucrats being paid with their tax dollars whose sole job is to prevent them from getting the best price possible on their products, I think they'd be outraged. And so I think the more we talk about this issue, the more and more people are going to wake up and demand that this antiquated 1939 law be changed, and hopefully we can unleash the true power of competition here in Wisconsin and do away with the minimum markup law.
Reporting for Our American Stories, I'm Alex Cortez.
Great job on that, Alex, and you can't make it up. And by the way, Walmart, I just looked it up because it's an amazing number. They save the average American family $2,500 a year with their discounts. You know, and in some places, folks, that's real money. Like in my household and everyone here at this show. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. We bring you the kind of stories that affect your pocketbook, the kind of stories that affect your lives. And you can see or hear all of it on OurAmericanNetwork.org. More after this. Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we like to move around and talk about all kinds of things, and one of them is music. And Jesse, I got to give you this one, because on this day in music history, well,
it's kind of combined with the water cooler.
It is. I think I'm getting
the
both.
Sound effect. But this day in history, it has to go with mention. Van Halen, the debut studio album by the American rock band Van Halen, was released. The album peaked at number 19 on the Billboard Hot 100, and it became widely recognized as the band's popularity grew, selling more than 10 million copies in the United States by 1999. It contained a lot of hits like Van Halen signature songs, including Running with the Devil, The Kinks cover You Really Got Me, Ain't Talking About Love, Jamie's Crying, other versions like Ice Cream Man. This album came out 2 years before I was born. It was way ahead of its time, like, you know, at least 10, 20 years, I think. But as a guitar player myself, one of the songs that got me into playing in the first place, I owed a debt of gratitude to this one song alone that Eddie Van Halen is very famous for. It, I believe, was the second track on the album, if not the first. But it was called Eruption. And I can't think for the life of me of any other guitar track that has its own solo track. And I think to pay respect, we should listen to that now.
So let's
here
do it.
Is Eruption. Yeah!
Thank you.
for it. Every time.
And that from a real, well, let's just say guitar head.
Monster.
And by the way, just a little bit about Eddie Van Halen, folks. Eddie, well, his family came from the Netherlands to America when he was 7.
Wow.
Yep. He showed up, he said, quote, "We showed up here with the equivalent of $50 and a piano." That's what he and his family came here. And we came halfway around the world without money, without a set job, no place to live, and we couldn't even speak the language. And Eddie went on to say, well, only in America. All I can say, he said, is only in America. And that's what we do here. We tell these kinds of stories. First, you hear one of the great riffs. And my goodness, he had the riff in the greatest selling album of all time. And that was Thriller.
Yeah.
And he teamed up with Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson. And he had that kind of talent with a guitar, and I don't know many guitar heads who don't put him up there in the top five. And we have already done Duane Allman, and we've done Robert Plant, but not Jimmy Page. And we will do Eric Clapton. Even though he's British, we consider him an honorary American because he loved the blues, and we're not far from Clarksdale, and we're not far from Memphis here in Oxford, Mississippi. So we spent a lot of time on music, and that was Jesse's favorite, so we gave him the floor. And earlier today, we were gathered around the tables and just doing what we do, talking about this or that. And I love playing the stock market. And so, we always keep the mics open because periodically we love to bring you a segment we call the water cooler segment. And here's what we were talking about earlier today. So I'm telling you, just buy Chipotle stock. Just buy it. I mean, if you got a spare $500, a spare $50,000, you know, a spare $1 million laying around, just boom, pop it in there.
You're going to let me half? You're going to lend me some money?
I'll cut
you in on half of the return.
I don't think we have one in here in Oxford. We could just open up our own chain, probably really cheap right now.
It would be cheaper. We need one here.
Well, I don't know about the Chipotle, but we have a gift card still from Christmas, and I just have troubles going in there because I just have problems with the restaurant in terms of just the guacamole issue. And I think most people that I've talked to have problems with the guacamole
issue.
I didn't know there was a guacamole issue at Chipotle. I get a burrito bowl.
Who do you know, by the way? I mean, there's like the people you know have a job.
No, they charge extra for the guacamole is the problem.
That's the problem.
No Mexican restaurant worth its salt is going to charge you extra
for
the guacamole.
Especially when they don't tell you. Well, you want some guacamole?
I know some Mexican restaurants that charge extra for the guacamole.
That's nonsense.
And that's fine. And
avocado
it's like 75
isn't that
cents
expensive.
Tops.
Yeah.
But the problem with these guys is you're almost getting punished for paying because they're going to punish you in kind of the opposite way that you would think. You would think, why don't I get some more for my money? No, they're going to punish you by just putting so much on that it's just no longer any good.
Yeah, it's a guacamole burrito at that
it
point.
Reminds me. It reminds me of this. Remember the Saturday morning cartoons? No, Lee might know this. Saturday morning cartoons in the 80s, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, along with the Conjunction Junction with Schoolhouse Rock. There was this one, and it says,
Don't dip your salad in the dressing. Don't drown your salad in the dressing. How about a wagon wheel?
No, maybe it's part of it.
It goes,
don't drown your food in mayo or ketchup or goo. It's no fun to eat what you can't see.
Yeah.
So don't drown your food. And that's what you're going
to do. Lewis, the lifeguard, and happy to say, I rescued a drowning potato today. They drowned it in sour cream. Oh, what a shame. Because food's so much better. It's practically plain. So don't drown your food.
So this is your problem. They put too much guac after you decide to pay. They give you so much guac that it's insulting and it ruins the whole meal.
Yeah.
It's a really sterile environment, too. I mean, you go to a Chipotle and it feels like you're going to a doctor's office. It's just like
It's very clinical.
It's so clean. I like a clean restaurant, but this is a bit like, it's so annoyingly clean.
So wait a second. First of all, we got one guy here who says Chipotle is too clean. This guy here doesn't like that they give you too much extra guac for the dollar
they
charge.
Meanwhile, the rest of the country is complaining that's giving him diarrhea.
Exactly right. Boy, this guy, maybe I'm not going to buy Chipotle stock. I didn't know there were this many deep anxieties about the company. Hengel, you need help.
But you eat 10 bags of apples a day? What was that?
Yeah. Well, not 10 bags. Well, I'll eat 10 apples a day.
All right. It's one apple a day.
Speaking of diarrhea.
But the problem is I'm just very particular. And the way some people are wine connoisseurs,
yeah.
I'm an apple and grape and watermelon connoisseur. Like, yeah. I'm very particular.
Can't say
and,
that's
like,
cool,
like Fuji apples. Or...
You know, you just don't. If you're eating a Granny Smith or Red Delicious, that's garbage.
What do you have against Granny Smith?
Oh, man.
I love Granny Smith.
It's kind of bitter. It's not a good apple. It's just like the two-buck chuck of apples. It's fine. It's fine. But when you got a good, what's that?
Like a Fuji or a...
No, Fujis are okay. That's a medium apple. Oh. We're talking like...
My bad.
Yeah. The Braeburn. I call it the kind of apples. It's the best... Overall, like there are some that are like a little bit better, but for the bang for your buck, if you want a perfect apple, the Braeburn apple will never.
So, how much more is a Braeburn apple than a Granny Smith apple? How much more money?
Probably
do I
like
pay?
70 cents a pound.
What's really
more.
Awful is those grainy apples. They look like a good apple when you bite into it. It tastes like it might have been frozen or something. Just it's kind of that really grainy texture, and there's just not much to it. It's kind of mushy in your mouth. What are those?
Oh yeah. Oh,
it's just like a fake apple.
You know what's worse than a Red Delicious or a Granny
Smith?
Yeah,
they look good.
A Macintosh. That's what you're talking about. Those things are
awful.
Yeah,
they look. It's such a letdown.
They're from Michigan. I'm thinking maybe they're from Detroit. I don't know.
So, Greg, how do you pick out your apples in the store? Don't you do something a little unique?
Well,
is that only what you do with your grapes?
That's what I do. That's what I do with my grapes.
What do you do with your grapes?
I sample them.
You eat them out of the bag?
Well, I have one, and I do have a bit of a.
So you put your hand into someone else's grapes and pull out a grape, and if you choose to not have those grapes, somebody has had your hand in that grape bag,
and they're one grape short.
Well, no, and they're a grape, exactly right.
I got no problem with this. I don't wash my stuff because as soon as I get in the car, I start eating the grapes or the.
My wife does this. She'll come home and she'll just put it under like the cold water and then dry it off and call it good. But if there's something really bad on there in the first place, it's not going to get it clean. Because you put some cold water over it. Right. You might as well just...
Plus, I always think of it as just a little extra fiber in your diet if you're eating dirt on the grapes. Sometimes my hands will actually have dirt on them from eating the grapes.
Yeah, I'll turn into a kidney stone in 5 years.
Oh, well, I don't want that.
You're moving past the important point, though. You're literally stealing these grapes.
No, but that's not stealing because it's considered fine.
Well, there you have it. Not serious. Not really very substantive. And we learned way too much about Hengler's eating habits.
I think that was very sad.
It is very, very sad. More with our crew, Jesse, Alex, Hengler, and Habib, after this. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And every once in a while, we want to dig into a book. It won't happen too often, but when we think the book is important and it has some timelessness to it and has some application in your daily life, or it's just damn interesting or fun, we're going to dig in. And this is one of those books, and it's all of the above, actually. It's fascinating. The book is Foolproof, Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. And it's one of Wall Street Journal's best writers, and he leads their economic team, and there's no better paper in America than the Wall Street Journal, which, by the way, I like to call America's Journal, because you don't have to follow Wall Street to enjoy and love the Wall Street Journal. And now we're going to dig into Chapter 1, and Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back, Lee.
You bet. What are you trying to convey with the title of this book, Greg?
Foolproof. The subtitle of my book is Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. And what I'm trying to convey with that is that sometimes the things we put in place to make our economy and our environment actually encourage us to take more risk or to not notice where risk is building, and that actually makes things more dangerous. And conversely, if we walk around with more of a sense of the danger and risk around us and adjust accordingly, that can keep us safe.
Let me tell you this. I want to, every once in a while, and I know it makes writers uncomfortable, but I actually read some things that writers write. So you're going to have to hear your own words for a second, Greg. But you write powerfully in this chapter that, quote, fear serves a purpose. It keeps us out of trouble. On the one hand, it's not much fun. A life lived in fear is also a life deprived of adventure, exploration, and growth. This tension suffuses modern life. Parents vacillate between walking their children to school every day to protect them from predators and worrying that they'll grow up sheltered and unable to cope with life. This tension also bedevils the people whose job it is to steer our economy and manage our surroundings. Greg, I love the way you link those two things together, because there's not a parent who has to think about balancing those two competing and dynamic tensions.
Oh, yeah, and I'm a parent myself, too, and believe me, I spend a lot of time trying to balance those tensions.
So talk about that. What you conclude that this reality leads us to two schools of thought. What are those two schools?
Yeah, well, let me do a little bit of take us back a little bit into some history now. So I go back in my book. I begin a century ago in what was known as the Progressive Era, when Teddy Roosevelt and then Woodrow Wilson were president. And this was an era when we had all this scientific and academic knowledge, and we thought we could better control the economy and the environment around us. There was a big financial panic in 1907, and that persuaded Congress to create the Federal Reserve so that there would be no more financial panics. There were also a big series of fires in the western United States in 1910, and this gave the Forest Service its new mission, which was to always put out wildfires. But the irony of both of those initiatives was that the Fed, in its very success at holding recessions and crises at bay, it often encourages people to take more risk, and that gives us larger crises. And the same irony is there with the Forest Service. By systematically always suppressing even small wildfires, they allowed more fuel to build up, they got denser forests, and when they caught fire, you got even bigger fires as a result. In fact, in the last decade, the fires have been bigger than ever, which is partly a consequence of the fact that the climate's warmer, but it's also a consequence of the fact that for the last century, we've been repeatedly putting out fires and leaving the forests thicker and more vulnerable to burning.
And, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you ever read it, but Max Boot wrote a book called Small Wars of Peace, in which he said if we periodically send small numbers of troops into little places and get them out, not giant boots on the ground numbers, but just 100, you know, Navy SEALs, 100, you know, Delta Force, taking care of little problems obviates the need and necessity for bigger wars. It sounds, I hate joining two books together, but it sounds like you're saying this is what we learned from the Federal Reserve entering into the fray in some respects, and also this this new approach to management of forest fires. We weren't allowing some of the little things to happen, thus building up potential for bigger and badder crises to occur.
Well, you might be onto something there, because, yes, I think that is one of the main points of my book, is that if we can tolerate smaller disasters, if I could use that word, then we're perhaps building up more resilience to larger disasters. And this is where the distinction comes in that I make between people I call engineers and people I call ecologists. And engineers, I think of people who have this great trust in their knowledge and their good intentions and their sort of technocratic approach to things, that there's no problem they can't solve. So if you're an economic engineer, you can basically get rid of recessions. And if you're an environmental engineer, you can get rid of wildfires and floods. On the other side, I have this school that I call the ecologists. And ecologists are very suspicious of engineers because they say, you know, economies and environments are complex things. And everything you do is going to have an unintended consequence. It's going to change people's behavior. So ecologists are suspicious that the Fed tries too hard to stamp out every recession or save every bank from failing. And they're very suspicious of the Forest Service's attempts to put out all the fires, or the Army Corps of Engineers trying to contain all the flooding with bigger and higher levees. And when you have something, for example, like levees collapse, they sort of say, I told you so, you know, you can't hold back the river. And similarly, when you have a big financial crisis, the ecologists turn around and say, that's the consequence of trying too hard to get rid of the natural, you know, rhythm of our market economy.
And I think this dynamic tension we're discussing between ecologists and engineers, you know, take it back to that family. I mean, I feel like I'm the ecologist in my family. I'm the one saying to my wife, let my little girl fall off the horse and she'll get back up and she's going to learn how to ride the horse better. And my wife's always trying to mitigate these things and she's always trying to protect my little girl from harm. And I believe deeply that that's going to bring more harm on my little girl. But God forbid something terrible happens. My wife's going to look at me, and God forbid my little girl's not prepared down the road for things that happen. I'm going to be looking at my wife, and I think maybe that's good for my girl, the two of us going through that dialogue.
And God forbid that I get between you and your wife on how to raise your little girl, Lee. But let me say this, that there are a lot of couples listening, I'm sure, that can sort of share that. You know, a lot of husbands and wives looking at each other and nodding their heads. And I have a lot of sympathy for that. I mean, who doesn't want to protect their child from any possible harm? But like we were saying at the outset, I think, doesn't everybody sort of understand that you've got to let your kid fall down and be hurt from time to time in order to understand how to stand on their own feet and develop resilience? You know, it's kind of interesting. There are studies that show that children who fall from heights when they're, say, 8 or 9 years old, for example, if they fall off some playground equipment, they have less fear of heights when they're when they grow up to be adolescents. So that's kind of interesting. Now, on the other hand, you can't deny the possibility that your wife might be right, that that one time they fall down is the one time they really have a serious injury and you'll be rushing him or her to the hospital. So there isn't a perfect answer here. Similarly, should we really tell the forest fires never to put that fire out? What if that's the one that becomes, you know, Yellowstone 1988 and ends up burning millions of acres?
Right.
It's not an easy question to resolve, and that's kind of one of the points I'm trying to make in my book, is that this tension has been going on for a century.
But I do think in the end, and I've had this discussion, and I can't tell you how much time I've had with these discussions with parents in my peer group right now, because in the end, resilience, I think, is what we want our kids to have. And how do we build it up? Because if our kids aren't resilient, it's a long life, and one day we're not going to be in it. We can't protect them anymore. And I think this is the truth and the case with economies, too, which brings me to the progressives. We didn't talk much about the progressives, but what's their opinion about this thing, resilience, and what's their answer to the resilience question? You got about a minute on that, Greg.
I think the original progressives a century ago didn't think much of that because they were so caught up with the new scientific advances that they didn't think they had to make a trade-off between resilience and safety. But I think that most people now recognize that there is a trade-off, and I'll give you one quick example. Antibiotics, we've been prescribing them way too much over the years, and that's why we have so much antibiotic resistance and the drugs are losing their efficacy. It is far better for us as a society to try and cut down on those things and suffer the occasional, you know, cold or germ now and then to protect society at large from more deadly pests, bugs.
You bet. And I think we all know that. You know, build up resistance, build up resilience. This is Lee Habib, and we're talking with Greg Ipp and his terrific book, Foolproof, Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. We'll be back with you next week, Greg, to dig into Chapter 2. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me, Lee.
You bet. And again, this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And more after these messages.
Had need of shelter from the evil, from the night. The devil wind was blowing, and from heaven came a light. The Son of God, a carpenter.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And, well, we love to talk about everything, from art to music. By the way, check out the Al Pacino hour we did, in his own words, about acting, the craft, and his life. Through his craft, not the gossip, not who he dated, but just how he did what he did. Particularly the part about The Godfather, but also Son of a Woman. Really good stuff. It's on our website, OurAmericanNetwork.org. We also love to talk about all sorts of things that affect you directly. Topics that really stick out because they touch every single aspect of our lives. Something like housing. which we dig into. We also dig into health and the law, because these are two other aspects of our lives that hit, and of course, finance. We're honored to discuss that topic of housing with our next guest, Dr. Arthur Laffer. You know him as one of President Reagan's key economic advisors, or maybe from the curve named after him, the Laffer Curve, which shows that raising tax rates will not only raise government revenue, because people will have less motivation to earn more when too much of it is going straight to the tax man. He was also one of the key minds behind California Prop 13, which put limits on property taxation and inspired a wave of similar initiatives across the country. Art, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Lee, for having me. It's a real pleasure.
You bet. You know, you've been a key advisor to Kansas Governor Sam Brownback as he tried to turn around an economy that had been underperforming for decades. And, Art, on this show, we love to talk about what's happening in the states, not Washington, D.C. As part of this bold pro-growth tax reform plan that you helped craft, it proposed complete elimination of the mortgage interest deduction. And after negotiations with the legislature, you were successful scaling it back by 50%. Why this deduction, Art, and how did you get there?
Well, let me just say that I didn't craft the plan for him. I maybe was the inspiration for it. And he called me and I came down and his plan was already done. But I can talk to you about the deduction there. I mean, in my view, strictly from economics, mortgage interest should be deductible against the income tax. It should be. You know, frankly, it makes no economic sense to not allow that deduction. But when you're looking at the tax plan that Sam was doing with his team there, you know, they had to worry about the total size of the tax cut, and he didn't want it to just be tax cuts. He wanted some offsets, and he proposed, as you may know, getting rid of the reduction in the sales tax rate, 1% sales tax add-on. He wanted to keep that, and he wanted to eliminate a lot of deductions, exemptions, and exclusions to make sure that the static revenue loss from his perspective wasn't so large. And that's exactly what he did, and that's why I think he did the not allowing the mortgage interest deduction.
And who gets that? Who are the people who get that? And look, this is a show that loves free enterprise, and it loves to keep the power closest to the people. But who benefits the most from these itemized deductions, ultimately, as it relates to mortgage deductions?
I wouldn't think about it in those terms, generally speaking, Lee. I mean, yes, you can. I mean, you can look at who's getting the favor, who's not, and trying to redistribute. But the world is dynamic. And when you change a tax rate or change a deduction, people adjust to it. Let me give you an example on that. What Sam did was pass through corporations, LLCs, partnerships, C-Corps, all the S-Corps, I mean, all of those. He eliminated the tax completely on all of those pass through corporations with the exception of certain items. But basically 180,000 taxpayers had their tax bill eliminated in their pass through corporation. And they estimated that there'd be 180,000 of them and that they'd lose that revenue. When the tax returns came in finally, there were 330,000 of them because lots of people shifted their behavior and moved their taxable entities to being a zero tax entity. That's what you're trying to do with taxes.
Right.
To change people's behavior.
But he's talking about this behavior and talking about what had happened in Kansas. I wanted to also bring out another tax issue that's in the news, and it has to do with inversions. And that's we're reading
same
about
thing.
This. And it's the same thing. But, like, can we take that talk of inversions right here into the United States? Because every time a company leaves New Jersey and goes to, let's say, Georgia, like Mercedes just announced at the end of last year, isn't that an inversion too, Art? And talk about those kinds of things.
Yeah, let me talk about that, too. I mean, you know, there have been 11 states that have introduced the income tax in the last 65 years. If you look at those 11 states, and it's, you know, it's Connecticut, it's West Virginia, it's Rhode Island, it's Maine, it's New Jersey, it's Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Illinois, Nebraska. I mean, these types of states, every single one of them has underperformed the economy since they put in the income tax. Every single one, in every single metric, they didn't even get the money. And their public services didn't improve. People, you can't tax an economy into prosperity. And when these people up north, in let's say on the coast, East Coast, start putting in all these taxes, the companies move to Georgia or move to Tennessee, where I now live. I moved here, Lee, purely and simply because there's no income tax in Tennessee.
Yep.
And, you know, I can't tell you how much I saved by doing that. I bought my house with my first year's tax savings.
Yeah, well, you know, I know a lot about that, as you can tell from this accent. I'm a New Jersey boy, but I live in Oxford, Mississippi. And when I told my friends in New Jersey I was moving down here, well, first of all, the only bigotry that's acceptable anymore these days, Art, as you well know, is regional bigotry. And so they looked at me like I'd sprung a new head. But then when I showed them my property tax bill, I showed them what my aggregate tax package was, particularly on that property tax bill, which in New Jersey is just so exorbitant. They were actually envious. And I've gotten a few of my wife's family members who live around the country to come back home to Mississippi, Art. And because of those taxes.
You want me to shock you?
Mm-hmm.
You ready for a shock statement?
You bet.
In 1965, New Jersey had neither an income tax nor a sales tax. 1965, 50 years ago, 51 years ago, had neither one. It was one of the fastest growing states in the nation. People from everywhere were moving into New Jersey, and they had a balanced budget. When my student was governor of New Jersey, a guy named John Corzine, 9 years ago, when he was governor, he was my student at the University of Chicago. And by the way, in full disclosure, he was a C student. And after MF Global, I'm not even sure you earned the C. You had the highest sales taxes, highest property taxes, highest income taxes. You were the slowest growing state in the nation. And people were leaving like rats out of a sinking ship. And you had a budget deficit. People respond to incentives. And if you tax people who work and pay people who don't work, you're going to get lots of people not working. And that's why Sam Brownback did what he did. That's why these other states are doing it. And that's why we're going to win the election come November.
Well, I think that's right. And who's getting this right? What states are getting this the best, Art? Who's doing the best? And are some of these other states starting to learn and pick up from some of the states who've been doing this successfully for a long time?
Yeah, I'm working very closely with West Virginia and Kentucky, two of the poorest performing states in the last century. I mean, really tragic cases. I've obviously worked with Sam Brownback, with Oklahoma. I've worked with a lot of other states as well, North Carolina with McCrory and all that group. And, you know, I specialize in state stuff. The ones that have got it right, and they really do, are the nine states with no earned income tax. You know, Texas, Tennessee, Florida. You know, you get Nevada, you get Alaska, you get Wyoming, you get South Dakota, you get New Hampshire. These are the states that are just kicking tush and really doing well. The 9-0 earned income tax rates are outperforming the highest income tax rate states every year for the past 50 years when you look at a 10-year growth period. It's just incredible how taxes really matter.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you look at it from every year or so, Atlas Van Company comes out with their who's moving where and where are they moving from. And I think that's better than almost any study. Because
I use that in the first chapter of my book, The Wealth of States. Thank you. Isn't that wonderful,
it's,
that one?
It's fantastic.
And they have the colors green, red.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And you know what it is? What's nice about it, Art, is it's not a public policy statement. It's just a statement of fact that no one can argue with. And there's New Jersey leading the pack 5 out of the last 6 years. You might be interested. I wrote a column about my dad leaving New Jersey because one day he realized a home, Art, he had paid $30,000 for in 1961, paid off in 7 years. His first property tax bill was $180. In 2013, he didn't tell us why he was selling the home, but I figured it out looking at his tax bills. He had a retirement income of $45,000, and he had a $15,000 a year tax bill. And if you would have ever told him, Art, in 1961 when he bought that home, that 2 years worth of taxes would have been the price of his home, he would have told me I was smoking something funny.
I know. Well, that's what the problem with the John Corzines of this world. I mean, they don't understand economics. They're just oblivious. You know, if you have two locations, Lee, location A and location B, if you raise taxes in B and you lower taxes in A, producers and manufacturers and people are going to move from B to A. As Larry Gatlin says, given that you're now a Southerner, as Larry Gatlin says, it ain't rocket surgery.
It is not rocket surgery. Art Laffer, we want to bring you back regularly to talk about these things. And, hey, when that Atlas Van Line study comes out, we should spend a week on it every day, pick it apart, because it's
Isn't
a wealth
fun?
Of information.
Yeah, I love it. You can't make this stuff up. You just can't make it up.
No, you cannot make it up. Art Laffer, a curve was named after him, folks. That's all I can say. Art Laffer, who's going to help us with economics and with your lives, making it make sense to you, the listeners. Art, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Lee.
You
Talk
bet.
You later.
You
Bye
bet.
Now.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you'll get everything from us. Economic talk and, well, water cooler talk. You name it, we've got it. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we love music here. Americans love music, and my goodness, we've invented all kinds of music. You're listening to Elton John, who came to America and fell in love with our blues music. This song, Benny and the Jets, well, it topped the R&B charts, and Elton became the first white person to ever perform on Soul Train, which had been an ambition of his. A deep ambition. Imagine that, a white British kid hung up. We learned that about Robert Plant. White British kid comes to the Delta, to Clarksdale, Mississippi, learns the blues, goes back to England, forms a little band called Led Zeppelin. Well, today for the hour, we're going to spend some time on a list that Jesse stumbled upon on the web, omgfacts.com, the top 20 records of all time by just sheer sales, not opinion, not Rolling Stone and the Sherpas over there and gurus telling us what to think about what the best music is. No, this is just the music the country bought. The American people voted, and these were the biggest records of all time. And that's Elton John's Benny and the Jets from Elton John's Greatest Hits, the 1974 compilation album. And the 11th official release for Elton. And it topped the charts in the United States and the United Kingdom, staying at number one for 10 consecutive weeks, which is a lifetime. And it's his best-selling album to date, being his first to have received an RIAA Diamond certification for U.S. sales at more than 16 million copies, which is why it's on this list. And we're going to rip through these for the hour. We're going to rip through all 20. Actually, we have 21. And my favorite on the record is track number 6, Jesse, Rocket Man, and it just always feels like the first time when I hear this.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space on such a timeless flight. Touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh no, 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 I'm a rocket man. Rocket man, burning out his fuse out of heaven.
It doesn't get much better than that, folks. That was off his Honky Chateau record. And that was when Elton was merging country influences, a lot of steel guitars on that record. Really simple Americana, you'd call it today.
Sounds cliche, but it takes you on a ride.
Yeah. It
so
does.
Big. Did he write that for the movie?
No, he just wrote it, and then it's been used 100 different ways.
I was just kidding. Yeah. You know the movie Rocket Man? Not a funny joke.
That was 20 years
ago. That's why it was funny. All right, well, the number 20, and we did a whole segment on not only this song, but we also did a real honorarium on and a tribute to Glenn Frey, who co-wrote this song. And the record is Hotel California. It's the fifth studio album by the Eagles, and one of the best-selling of all time. Three singles, The New Kid in Town, Life in the Fast Lane, and this, the title track. It sold 16 million copies in the United States alone. Let's listen to Don Henley. Number 19 is a little British band that sold a hell of a lot of records in the United States. And there's Led Zeppelin. We were talking just about Robert Plant a bit ago. And go on our website, OurAmericanNetwork.org, and listen to our half hour on Robert Plant and his two trips to America to discover himself. First, the blues, and then later on in his life, American roots music and the Band of Joy. Physical Graffiti is their sixth studio album. And my goodness, it doesn't get better. My favorite, by the way, of all the Zeppelin records. And that's because it has track number 6, Cashmere, on it. Jimmy Page comes up with this riff. And then that distinctive voice of Robert Plant coming in over the guitars, over the great drum work of John Bonham. This was not a single record, by the way. It was a double. And the songs aren't short. The songs are complex. They take you places that only Zeppelin could take you on. And very few choruses and breakdowns. Very unusual writing. A very unusual and brilliant band. Let's go out with Robert Plant and Jimmy Page. Number 19, Physical Graffiti. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Top 20 albums. We're going through them this hour of all time. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we love music, and we love to talk about music and play music and tell stories. And, well, the greatest music always tells a story, and actually it brings you back to places. And it brings you back to places in ways almost nothing else does. So you're listening to Metallica's Enter Sandman. And this is number 18. From the list that Jesse dug up from omgfacts.com, the top 20 records of all time, not opinion, just record sales. How the American public voted with their pocketbooks, with their money. So this isn't about opinions, folks. This is just omgfacts.com. We thought it was fun. We thought we'd rip through them for you because we were surprised at some of them. And some of them were like, OMG, why are they here?
Yeah, there's no way that that black album of Metallica is better than Injustice for All or Ride the Lightning.
A lot of Metallica fans didn't like this album because it was considered their sellout album.
I remember when it came out. Yeah. I remember. It was in 89 or 90. I remember that. Yeah. And it was just not that great. It wasn't classic Metallica.
You guys are snobs. The people have spoken.
The people have spoken.
Forget the people.
16 million people were wrong.
A reporter approached the drummer, Lars Ulrich, about this album. He says, have you guys sold out? And Lars said, yeah, we sold out. We sell out every night.
That's pretty funny. And that's why Lars is a drummer and not a stand-up.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you who didn't sell out, because everybody thought these guys were sort of sellouts anyway. This is just a straight pop band. And it's, of course, Cracked Rear View by Hootie and the Blowfish. And, of course, Hold My Hand was just a gigantic, gigantic hit for them.
With a little love and some tenderness, we'll walk upon the water, we'll rise above the mist. With a little peace and some harmony, we'll take the world together, we'll take them by the hand.
The critical reviews were mostly positive, but soon thereafter, the critics started really dumping on Hootie and the Blowfish. But let me tell you, they sold a lot of records. 16 million.
Wow. Makes me want to get my million. Hacky sack out and go throw a frisbee in the park or something.
It does. It does.
Takes you back.
Did you guys hear about Hootie's car? Didn't he do something crazy with his car?
He
put like military equipment or something.
I like how everybody calls the lead singer Hootie. His name is not Hootie.
He's not Hootie.
That was just to set you up, Greg.
Thanks.
Well, let's go to number 16, and it's a country act and a great writer. Say what you want about this guy, whatever you think about this guy. He writes his stuff, and his name is Garth Brooks. And, well, in 1990, No Fences reached number one on the Billboard Top Country Album charts. And my goodness, this one sold a couple of records, too. 17 million. And, well, I don't think there's a better bar song than this one by Garth. And, well, the lyrics are just so darn good.
Blaming all of my roots, I showed up in boots and ruined your blind tie affair. The last one to know, the last one to show, I was the last one you thought you'd see there. And I saw the surprise and the fear in his eyes when I took his glass of champagne. And I toasted you and said, honey, we may be through, but you'll never hear me complain. 'Cause I got friends in low places where the whiskey.
And Garth, well, he went on to sell so many more records. I don't think there was a bigger selling country act. Meanwhile, his favorite acts were rock acts. Billy Joel, too.
James Taylor.
Alex, did you ever sing this one in a bar?
Yeah, it was like 3 a.m. Jesse and I were talking about it earlier. This is one of the few karaoke songs we've done.
Nice.
Yeah. With a bunch of friends.
Guilty.
We want the video. We want the video. Well, now we get to number 15, and this takes me back to my high school days, and I'll never forget hearing this for the first time through a car speaker and going, what the heck is this? And it was this band called Boston. And there was this song, and it was the way they layered the guitars. And I mean, we played this, everybody played this until, well, you couldn't listen to it anymore. And then you listen to it some more.
This morning, and the sun was gone. Turned on some music.
And by the way, what was really funny is having a few drinks and trying to get through the chorus, and nobody knew the words. Nobody knew them. I feel like a zombie. I feel like I'm zoning, and it doesn't matter. And we don't even want to know what the words are.
There are more Boston cover bands in Los Angeles than any other band.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah. And by the way, that one sold 17 million copies, too. My goodness. Not a bad debut record. Next on the list, well, it's a soundtrack from a movie. And we just covered one of the writers of the big songs on this, Dolly Parton. And Whitney Houston belted it out. And I think it's why the soundtrack sold as many copies as it did. And, of course, it was the soundtrack to The Bodyguard. And this one, well, it was Whitney and Clive Davis. And Clive, my goodness, we've got to do an hour on Clive Davis because he's another one of those record impresarios like Ahmet Ertegun, who we covered, who is the founder of Atlantic Records. And go to our website, OurAmericanNetwork.org, and listen to that hour, the man who discovered Ray Charles, who took the Stones to a new place, and Led Zeppelin, and Otis Redding, and Aretha Franklin. It just goes on and on. One guy. Well, 17 million copies, and the hit song that everybody knows and everybody remembers, Dolly's own, I Will Always Love You.
If I should stay, I would only be in your way. So I'll go, but I know I'll think of you every step of the way. And
whatever kind of music you listen to, it doesn't get much better in terms of pure singing and pure writing than that. And I'm not a big pop fan. But oh my goodness, if you don't get moved by that, you got to examine your heart. Chuck yourself into a clinic. Get the thing cleaned out. Heal thyself. Let's hear a little bit more from Whitney. And when we come back, we'll dig into the Beatles, Guns N' Roses, so much more. This is Our American Stories. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and catch all of what we do. Today, the top 20 best-selling records of all time, compiled by OMGFacts.com with a little help from Jesse Edwards. More after this. And this is Our American Stories. And for the hour, the top 20 selling albums of all time. And I mean gross record sales. No opinions here, nothing subjective. Bicker with these numbers if you like, but the American people voted with their wallets. And this was assembled by OMGFacts.com. And we thought, what the heck, let's rip through these. And this one, of course, well, that's the Beatles. But it's not from Revolver, which is where the song originally appeared. It's actually from the Beatles' 1967 to 1970, widely known as the Blue Album. There was a red companion as well. And this one sold 17 million records. Number 13. And my goodness, there are so many big hits on this that you can't go through the Beatles catalog without just being humbled. And they did it all in about 6 years. In about 6 years, they wrote some of the best records of all time. Next on the list, number 12. This may be the greatest opening guitar riff to any song ever written, my humble opinion. My wife's favorite band. So you don't mess with that. And the record Appetite for Destruction, the band, well, we know the band, and it's Guns N' Roses. Let's take a listen. That was 1987.
Wow.
Geffen Records. Over and over, Geffen Records just found the talent. Way back when they signed Laura Nyro and a little girl named Joni Mitchell. Then through rock and roll, then right up to the Counting Crows. I mean, I could just go on and on with the talent Geffen and his guys had for finding talent. This record, the best-selling debut album ever. 11th best-selling album in the United States. 18 million sold. Not bad. Let's look at number 11. Oh my goodness, we're back to that British band and an album known as the White Album. And the George Harrison composition, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, may be one of the best, but my goodness, you could argue over and over again about which one was the best, a double record. And that's the thing about the Beatles. Harrison could come in and slay you. Then Lennon would come in with one of his compositions, McCartney with one of his. Everything said Lennon and McCartney, but the fact of the matter is, if you know anything about the Beatles, one of them generally wrote most of the song, and then the other one would take it over the hump, so they just shared writing credit. But this was written solely by George Harrison. Let's take a listen.
Sleeping while my guitar gently weeps.
And now we're cracking into the top 10. Another British band and a blues band. Again, they started with the blues with a guy named Mick Fleetwood in the pit. And then ultimately, they just kept adding great singers and songwriters. And the band is Fleetwood Mac. And the album, Rumours, a perfect record. And, well, the big hit on that record, well, it was this. Lindsey Buckingham, Go Your Own Way. Take a listen. What was so interesting about this band is they had multiple singers. So you'd go from a rocker like this to something like track two and the remarkable vocals of Stevie Nicks.
You are.
Well, now we're breaking into the top 10 and we're down to number 9. And Come On Over was the third studio album recorded by this Canadian singer, Shania Twain, released in 1997. And it sold a whopping 20 million copies. 20 million copies. Love Shania. Don't love her. She's on this list. And here's just one of the big tracks that everybody knows from this moment on.
From this moment, life has begun. From this moment, you are the one. Right beside you is where I belong. From this moment on, from this moment, I have been blessed. I live on thee.
Now we're looking at number 8, and he's already had one on this list, No Fences. And Double Live is the first and only live album by an American country music artist to chart as it did. And again, it's Garth Brooks. A two-disc live album that sold 21 million copies. And The Dance, which Garth wrote, may be one of his finest. Let's take a listen.
Looking back on memory of the dance we shared beneath the stars above. For a moment, all the world was right. How could I have known you'd ever say goodbye? And that, glad I didn't know where it all would end.
And we're going to now squeeze in the number 7 album. And it's the 7th studio album by an Australian band. And the album is Back in Black. And well, You Shook Me All Night Long. They still play it at every stadium in America.
Every time.
Every time. And it still rocks the house. Guess how many copies? 22 million. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Story. The top 20 albums of all time. We're running through them. Right here. We'll be back with more. We'll go out with You Shook Me All Night Long by AC/DC. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're hearing the opening riff from Billy Joel's Piano Man. We're ripping through the top 20 albums of all time, not subjective, the top 20 sellers of all time. OMGFacts.com put out the list. We were just loving it, so we figured let's spend an hour and rip through it. And this is Billy Joel's Greatest Hits Collection, double album, sold 23 million copies. And well, this was one of the greatest songs. This launched his career, this song. But what made Billy Billy was his ballads. When you'd go to a concert and break everything down And then there was no denying this guy's talent as a writer and a singer, because there he was alone at Madison Square Garden and playing something like this.
She's got a way about her. I don't know what it is, but I know that I can't live without her. She's got a way of pleasing. I don't know why it is, but there doesn't have to be a reason anyway.
And now we're getting to number five. And it was the 11th studio album by this English progressive rock band. Some call them Floyd. And it's Pink Floyd. And again, we did a great segment on this song, how it was made, how it got stuck in the studio, and what unstuck it. And we don't want to tell you anymore. Go to our website, ouramericannetwork.org, and hear the story. As told by Roger Waters and some of the school kids who actually recorded the chorus. That background of the chorus. And we're listening to Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2. This record sold, well, in 1979, it was released. And 23 million purchases later, this made its way to number 5 on the list. And now we get to number 4, and, well, it's the same band. It's Pink Floyd, and it's The Dark Side of the Moon, and it sold 24 million albums. It was an immediate success. Recorded in Abbey Road Studios in London in two sessions, in 1972 and 1973. The group used some of the most advanced recording techniques of the time, including multi-track recording and tape loops. Let's take a listen to Time. There haven't been many bands like it before and since. And you just have to put that record on and play it from beginning to end. And by the way, if you have vinyl and you got a great, great turntable, nothing sounds better than vinyl. And thank goodness for the hipsters. They're bringing vinyl back. And now on to number 3. The untitled 4th studio album by the English rock band Led Zeppelin. Physical Graffiti was there earlier. Known as Four, Led Zeppelin Four. Produced by Jimmy Page. Recorded between 1970 and 71 at several locations. Mostly in a home. In England. A home recording. Can you imagine that? Four had so many great songs. Black Dog, Rock and Roll, Misty Mountain Hop, Going to California. And of course, it had this, their signature song, the song everybody wished they'd written. The record would go on to sell 25 million albums. Not bad. And of course, when John Bonham died, so did Zeppelin. And how many bands, when they lose a drummer, fold it up? And that's how tight a band this was. And that's how great a drummer John Bonham was.
Your head is humming and it won't go, in case you don't know.
You know, people may not have liked the record labels, and they're dead now. But YouTube is not producing this kind of music, folks. It just ain't. Now, I can't wait for the labels to make a resurgence, for an A&R guy to find a band like this, and I'm out Ertegun to get behind a band like this. There's no chorus. This is an 8-minute song. It has no beginning and middle and end in a way. It's just one seamless piece of art. Now we're on to number two, a very different kind of record, but what a big one. And it's Thriller. Epic Records, Michael Jackson. Recorded at Westlake Recording Studio in L.A. with a budget of $750,000, a pretty big one back then, and assisted by a guy who knew a thing or two about making records, way back to the great records he made with Frank Sinatra, Quincy Jones. The album's 9 tracks, 4 were written by Jackson, 7 singles were released from the album, all of which made the top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100. It would go on to sell 29 million records. Let's take a listen to Thriller. And what Jackson did with his videos was as remarkable as what he did with this record. And I think whatever you thought of MTV, at its height, it was such a pleasure. And one day we'll have to do the top 20 MTV videos of all time. But Jackson took making videos to another place. Another place. And that brings us to the number one record of all time. They had one earlier. And it was a little hit called Hotel California. But this record, The Eagles' Greatest Hits, well, it was the first compilation album by The Eagles. It was released in 76. If you own a car and you drive and you don't have this record, there's something wrong with you. Or you're just a hater from this really great band from California, because they had a lot of haters. But it was the best-selling album in the United States and the best-selling album of the 20th century. It would go on to sell over 30 million albums. Let's take a listen to Take It Easy.
Take it easy, take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy. Like no
Maybe it was because they were too good looking. Maybe it was because the girls liked them. Maybe it was because those melodies were so sweet. Maybe it was because they were such great singers. Maybe it was because they were such great writers. So many people had no respect for this band, but the numbers don't lie on this one, folks. 40 million. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the 20 best-selling albums of all time, brought to you by our team. Thanks, Jesse, for all the work on this. And go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear all of what we do.